This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security for your savings.
A very warm welcome to This Is Money and Share Radio podcast in partnership with NS&I. I'm Georgie Frost here with you on DAB across the country. We're online and through the Share Radio mobile app. I'm here every weekday from 9 until midday sharing ideas about money. And I'm joined today in the studio by editor Simon Lambert and personal finance reporter Rebecca Rutt to go through some of the stories that they've been looking at this week. And is the unreliable boyfriend back?
If the outlook has worsened, to use that term, in the judgment of the MPC, there always could be monetary response.
But surprise, no change.
It's fine to take time to get these decisions right. That's what we've told private citizens to do. Don't do a knee-jerk reaction. But then flagging that you do one thing and do another, that just creates uncertainty, and that's not what we need.
Well, the Bank of England keeping rates unchanged despite widespread expectation to the contrary. What now for the economy, especially with a new prime minister in place?
Brexit had cast a big shadow over the British economy. The country was leaderless. Today we've got a new prime minister in place. We've got a new cabinet. So there's a lot more political certainty.
Yeah, so it's been called the week of the long knives. All change in the cabinet. We reflect on where the country is heading now. Meanwhile, we're hearing how Brexit has put the brake on house sales.
The young couple were first-time buyers. When Brexit happened, they read somewhere that house prices would go down, and they got scared.
We've been hearing buyer demand fell at its sharpest rate on record. Will it last? And as if buying a home wasn't tough enough, we take a look at another worrying new trend.
Portal juggling is a real problem for those looking to buy or rent properties because it gives a false impression of what estate agents have to sell and to let.
And talking of worrying new trends,
seen a rise in claims for vandalism, things like keying cars and the like. And it can all so easily be avoided by being more considerate and just being a little bit more chilled when you're behind the wheel.
Yeah, chill out. We're talking parking range, something those with electric cars may not need to worry about soon. Lots of spaces to be made available as one town vies to be the greenest in the UK.
The place I actually do live, I do have an office and I do currently, I will be working there later on today when I leave these fine offices. And that, of course, is Milton Keynes.
Milton Keynes, no less. But I am asking today. Interest rates may not have changed since March 2009, but I bet your life has. And I want to know how. Pick out a key event for me, if you would, Simon and Rebecca. I also want to know if you can remember, particularly March 2009, what were you up to then? A very good morning, Simon. A very good morning, Rebecca.
Good morning.
To you, Simon, first. Police, what were you doing back in March 2009?
Oh, what was I doing in March 2009? I was reporting on the last time that the Bank of England moved interest rates. In fact, I dug out a story from then yesterday in the build-up to that exciting moment when interest rates might possibly have changed and then didn't go anywhere. Because we were talking about how we used to do a roundup called Has Your Mortgage Rate Changed? And we used to basically pull
Catchy title.
Well, yeah, exactly. Does what it says on the tin. And we would basically pull up all the mortgage lenders and whether they had lowered their standard variable rates in line with the Bank of England or whether they'd lowered them by less. And they didn't used to like this, actually, because basically it was one place you could go to and you could see had your bank done the dirty on you and not cut your rate. So that I can remember doing in March 2009. What has changed substantially in my life since then? Well, at that point, I was assistant editor on This Is Money. I'm now the editor, obviously. That's changed.
Yep.
But I've got two kids.
Yeah, I was going to say.
My kids are five and three. So my eldest daughter was born in October 2010. And that is probably the biggest change to my life.
I'd imagine so. Although it came second to being promoted to editor of This Is Money.
I was just pointing out that I was doing something the same but slightly different.
I see. Simon, how about you, Rebecca?
2009, I graduated in 2008 and then worked for six months. Then went travelling. So I was probably Thailand, I think. Yeah, I was travelling for 9 months, so nice. I missed out on a lot of drama back in the UK.
But
I was
so you were out enjoying the sun and the beaches of Thailand, and now fast forward 89 months, and you are stuck in the studio in London with me. Apologies.
Looking pretty grey outside.
For that. Yes, sir?
Becky just reminded me of something else that I did in March 2009. That was the year after I got married, and we went on a two-week snowboarding holiday in March, basically. We decided that normally we do 1 week, but we decided 1 week wasn't enough and we'd make the most of it, and we went for 2 weeks.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost, weekdays from 9 till 12, wants your feedback. Contact the programme by tweeting at Share Radio UK. Text 66777 and start the text with the word share. Or email consumingissues@shareradio.co.uk. If it's about money and it matters to you, it matters to us.
A very warm welcome if you've just joined us. I'm Georgie Frost. This is Share Radio, the team from the financial website of the year, This Is Money, are back in the studio with me for our weekly catch-up in partnership with NS9. I'm joined today by editor Simon Lambert and personal finance reporter Rebecca Rutt to go through some of the stories that they've been looking at this week. And no seven-year itch for the Bank of England. No change in interest rates. Despite widespread expectation to the contrary, the Monetary Policy Committee voted 8-1 to keep them at that historic low of 0.5% where they've been since, yes, March 2009, when Simon was on a two-week snowboarding holiday and Rebecca was in Thailand. I was in London. With Brexit nervousness, though, and economic data deteriorating, markets had priced in an almost 80% chance of a rate cut this week in order to stimulate the economy and help it reach its 2% inflation target. Certainly all the noise from the Governor, Mark Carney, since the EU vote had suggested as much. Former Pensions Minister and indeed This Is Money pensions agony uncle, Steve Webb, questions the way Mr. Carney, though, has gone about it.
It's fine to take time to get these decisions right. That's what we've told private citizens to do. Don't do a knee-jerk reaction. But then flagging that you do one thing and do another, that just creates uncertainty, and that's not what we need.
So is this the return of the unreliable boyfriend, as one MP called Mr. Carney a few years back? Share Radio senior analyst Ed Boucher isn't sure that's fair, especially as the minutes of the meeting showed most members do expect action to be taken next month.
In fairness to Mark Carney, when he made comments, he said he was keen to do monetary stimulus at some point this summer. Monetary stimulus didn't necessarily mean a base rate cut, but many people thought we'd see it. But we're seeing the Monetary Policy Committee, on which there are nine people, eight members of that committee have voted to keep the base rate static at 0.5%. One gentleman said it should be cut to 0.25%. Of course, there'll be another meeting in a month, so maybe we'll get a rate cut then, but certainly nothing for now. I can only assume they thought it was too early to be sure. Obviously, Brexit's been a very big thing, and everyone's trying to figure out how big the economic impact is going to be, how big the impact will be on financial markets. And although we've got some idea now, it's still early days. The stock market's gone up a lot, so that's perhaps been a bit of a surprise on the positive side. So I guess the bankers have decided, well, let's just sit on our hands for a month, see how things go until we get more information. The economy doesn't seem to be going into a total sort of disaster area, a massive, very quick crash. So perhaps there's no need to give this emergency support now.
Well, that was Share Radio senior analyst Ed Boucher there. Simon, before we get to the subject of your column this week, just wanted to know, a surprise? The economy is not in a total disaster area yet. What do you make of the Bank of England's decision then?
I wasn't surprised at all, actually. I said I thought that they would hold yesterday morning.
Smart.
But then I followed that up with the comment, mind you, we thought we were going to remain in the EU as well, didn't we? But I wasn't surprised. I think that they might cut in August, to be honest. And that's what everyone's suggesting now. But we run a roundup. What next for interest rates? When will interest rates, rise or fall, it should be, now? But, we've been doing that for many years. And we look at economists' forecasts, what the money markets are suggesting, and so on and so on. And that's where this 80% likelihood comes from. But the point that we make in there is that these forecasts are regularly wrong and have regularly been wrong for the past 7 years. Mm. So you can't rely on them too much. And so I wasn't surprised when that forecast was wrong yesterday. It's just another example of why you should.
But what was the reason for not cutting?
Well, the reason is why. Why did we need to? They're trying to assess the situation. And actually, if you look at what Carney said, he said, in my view, and I'm not prejudging the views of the other independent MPC members, the economic outlook has deteriorated and some monetary policy easing will likely be required over the summer. The committee will make an initial assessment on 14th of July and a full assessment complete with a new forecast will follow in the August inflation report. Mm-hmm. In August, we will also discuss further the range of instruments at our disposal. So he didn't say we're going to cut rates in July. Now, people decided that he had said we're going to cut rates in July, but he didn't say that. So I don't think it's... I think it's a little bit unfair, some of the comments being directed at him. I think that they probably will cut, but cutting's a big thing. It's like there's not really that much further to go from 0.5% down. So, yeah, you know, you've got to use it sparingly. And Rachel Rickard Strauss, our personal finance editor, wrote a really good column about this yesterday, in which she talked about the fact that, you know, what you're seeing is the central bankers don't just do stuff. They do thinking about stuff, telling you they're thinking about stuff. You know, there's this thing where they tell you stuff because telling you is almost as good as actually doing it. And there's this thing, the Maradona feint, right? Mm-hmm. So Maradona would run at players and he would look like he was going to go from side to side. So all the players would expect him to go from side to side and then he'd just run straight through the middle. Mm-hmm. He didn't even have to move from side to side. And that's this suggestion that what central bankers do is they do the Maradona feint. They look like they're going to do something and then they just keep going in a straight line. And Carney is the master of going in a straight line. Bear in mind that this man has basically not done anything in the whole time he's been in charge of the Bank of England.
I agree, but I think also people are quite worried at the moment about their finances. And I think if the rate, it's quite a big change for that to happen. So I think it's kind of just making sure everyone's kind of comfortable and there's no like real knee-jerk reaction. So I think, again, I don't even know what will happen in August, I have to say. At the moment, seeing as what's happened so far, I think it'll be quite a long time before anything changes.
I'm wondering as well, is it sort of a sign that perhaps Brexit's impact on the economy wasn't so bad?
Well, I don't think... Initially? Yeah, so if we'd have seen much more volatility, so if the stock market was down by lots, if the banking sector looked like it was in trouble, if liquidity was drying up, banks weren't lending, you know, the key measures that show whether banks are lending were like going haywire, then I think maybe they might have stepped in already. But yeah, as Becky says, it's a confidence thing. And nothing says, you know, we've got confidence in the economy like maintaining rates, you know, and nothing says we're really worried like cutting them. So cutting them does say we're really worried. And maybe they're thinking we don't want to send that message.
And then, like you said, how far to go? There's not a lot of wiggle room, is there? Holding some ammunition back. And indeed, the data in which they are working on, anything like hard economic data, figures for retail sales, employment, industrial production, now they won't be available until September. Even survey evidence on business plans won't be published until August. I want to give you some stats, though. The interest rate in the UK averaged 7.82% from 1971 until 2016. It reached an all-time high of 17% in November 1979, a record low, of course, of 0.5% in March 2009. 17%. So when we're talking about a smidge of 0.25% potentially cut, Rebecca, what impact is that likely to have?
Firstly, 17%. That figure like astounds me. Especially compared to today, I just can't even imagine it. But I think it's probably not going to make a huge amount of difference. I think it's more just waiting and seeing what happens. But as you say, it's such a small amount, it's probably not going to dramatically affect the economy.
So, Simon, it leads on to your article. What is the point in cutting interest rates? The magician's trick of how banks create money explains why. Go.
This is the question that many people will ask. What is the point in cutting interest rates? I mean, literally, what's the point? So it comes down to this really interesting but obscure Bank of England paper actually explained how banks create money. Now, banks take your savings and they lend them out, don't they? That's what they do, yeah? No, they don't do that at all. What banks do when they make a loan is effectively they actually create money. So when you borrow that £100,000, £200,000 mortgage, the bank sits there and it makes the decision to lend. And then when the bank lends you the money, with the computer keystroke, it creates £200,000, gives you £200,000. But it doesn't give you £200,000 in cash. It electronically transmits the idea of £2,000 to you. And then you do that to someone else and you do that to someone else. Mm-hmm. And eventually it ends up deposited probably back in the banking system. So the way that new money is created is basically by making loans. Now, the tools that the Bank of England has to control how much of that goes on, it has a number of them in its box. But basically, if you think about what the limits are on the banks, is they can't just do this to an unlimited amount. It might look from the 2000s credit boom like they were doing this to an unlimited amount, but that's a great example of when this kind of system goes completely haywire. But the limits on banks doing this is to make sure that their lending is profitable, so they're making money off the back of it, that it's not too risky, that it fits within regulation, which is very important. You know, there's regulations that control how big their balance sheets are can be compared to how much capital they hold. And also that there's demand for it, because you can't create all this money and make lots of new loans if nobody wants to borrow it off you. So those are the limits that are imposed on the banks, by the banks on themselves, essentially, that, that their businesses are run properly. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the scenario we had in 2000 to 2007, I think you can suggest that a lot of those businesses weren't being run properly, and that's why we saw that massive expansion in credit. And then there's basically what the bank refers to as the ultimate constraint, monetary policy. And this is what the bank can do. By setting the rate paid on central bank reserves, i.e. the base rate, the Monetary Policy Committee influences the rate at which banks will lend to each other. This then feeds through into the rates that they charge on loans and offer on savings. And the idea is that the cheaper borrowing is, the more demand there will be for it. Because if something's cheaper, more people will go out and buy it. So if loans are cheaper, more people will go out and take them out. And then the more money banks will create through new loans. And if you think of it like a bathtub. Mm-hmm. And you've got money coming in at the top through the tap, and then you've got this big pool of money in the bath, right? But if the plug's open, which it is, basically, that water can come out. And what's the water coming out at the bottom is basically people repaying loans. So if people are repaying their loans, then they're essentially cancelling out that money that has been conjured up. And if people are repaying those loans too quickly, the water in the bath is going down too quickly, then central bankers worry about there not being enough money flowing around the economy. So they try and turn on the taps a bit more at the top by lowering interest rates. And that's what the bank would be saying, basically, if it cuts interest rates, is it wants these banking magicians to pull some more money out of the hat. They would be saying, we want you to conjure up more money. Now, the question is that a good idea? I mean, you know, we are obviously dealing with a very highly indebted society and highly indebted world. Mm. And is more debt and more loans the answer to that problem? Many of our readers and many of our listeners would say no.
Well, that's it. You say, so if the Bank of England cuts rates, it'll be saying to banks, we want you to conjure up more money. Is that a good idea? You tell me. I'm probably not the only one who now has images, though, of Margot Robbie in The Big Short with all that bath analogy. I do want to say it's not just about cutting interest rates, though, as well. Policymakers also voted to leave the banks QE quantitative easing programme on a hold at $375 billion. Your thoughts about all of that as well? Presumably the same thing?
Yeah, QE. QE is a bit like the central bank creating money. That's unusual monetary tools. That's where it basically buys government bonds off asset managers and insurers who hold them as like part of their own holdings. So it buys them off them, and then with the money that it's created to buy those bonds, those asset managers and insurers will then go out and seek to make returns on it, normally by buying riskier assets like buying shares or corporate bonds, and eventually that money kind of filters down into the system. The question is whether QE benefits anything other than the financial system and the prices of hard assets like houses, you know, for example. And what we saw off the back of all that QE was financial markets go up by a lot, house prices go up by a lot, paintings, classic cars, all those kind of alternative investments. But it's a bit dubious as to how much of it got into the real economy. So I think the bank would like to hold off doing that as much as possible. And I think actually we are more likely to see something that I've advocated, which is maybe some government borrowing to spend on infrastructure and stuff like that.
Which leads us very nicely, because with Westminster in chaos, it did fall, didn't it, in the last couple of weeks, to the Governor of Bank of England to calm markets, households and businesses in the wake of the Brexit vote. But as Mr Carney himself pointed out, now is the time for ruthless truth-telling, he said. And one uncomfortable truth is that there are limits to what the Bank of England can do. So what can we expect then to happen to our economy under new leadership? It was the week we heard of the long knives as Theresa May formed her new cabinet. Indeed, at the start of the week, we were expecting a very long campaign. We didn't get that. The early changes perhaps bringing the biggest shocks. Chancellor George Osborne, Chancellor no more, sacked and replaced by Philip Hammond, seen as the low-key fiscal hawk. Boris Johnson, of course, coming in as Foreign Secretary. His German counterpart, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, says it's outrageous.
It is bitter for Great Britain. people there are experiencing a rude awakening after irresponsible politicians first lured the country into a Brexit, to then, once the decision was made, bolt and not take responsibility.
Well, Mrs May continued sacking Conservative frontbenchers by phone, we were hearing during the week. Gone is Justice Secretary Michael Gove, to be replaced by Liz Truss. Education Secretary Nicky Morgan is out. In comes Justine Greening. John Whittingdale also left his role as Culture Secretary. Cabinet Office Minister Oliver Letwin is out. Jeremy Hunt staying on as Health Secretary. Patrick McLaughlin moves from Transport to become party chairman. But let's focus our attention on our new Chancellor, Philip Hammond.
The economy has taken a shock. The markets, businesses, consumers were not expecting the Brexit decision. But I think, you know, a couple of weeks, 3 weeks later, that has now sunk in. We will take whatever measures are necessary to restore confidence, stabilise the economy as we move forward with the start of the negotiating process. And let's try to get to a conclusion as quickly as we possibly can so that people can see how we're going to take this economy forward in the new circumstances. The number one challenge is to stabilise the economy, send signals of confidence about the future, the plans we have for the future, to the markets, to businesses, to international investors. Britain is open for business. We are not turning our back on the world. We are determined to maintain our outward-looking stance, and we are determined to maintain the prosperity of our people and keep on growing the economy and creating jobs in the future. And that's the message I want to get out there. And we will do whatever we need to do to restore that confidence and to keep Britain as an attractive destination for businesses to invest and create jobs.
So wasting no time there as Chancellor, Mr Hammond making concerted efforts to reassure companies that the new government would do, quote, whatever is necessary to keep the economy on track. Indeed, he met Mark Carney, Governor of the Bank of England, the morning of the rate decision, and they will spend this summer, Britain's new Chancellor, of course, and Central Bank Governor, thrashing out a coordinated plan to restore confidence to households and business as they try to prevent the economy sliding into recession in the wake of the vote to leave the EU. But what do we know about Philip Hammond, Rebecca?
Well, it's interesting. It's very early days, but I think so far the message has been this stabilise the economy and kind of calming people down a bit. Whereas with Osborne, it was, all his budgets were about austerity and cuts and a lot of the fix the roof when the sun is shining, all in it together. Mm. Whereas I think with Hammond, it's more looking forward as to what's going to happen with Brexit, and no one really has much idea how he can bring confidence to people. And I guess that we'll see what happens.
I guess in terms of his CV, it's always relatively good news. Your new Chancellor does have a degree in economics, securing first-class honours. So not too bad at the University of Oxford, no less. So well done to him. He's also spent quite a long time in industry, which I suppose might help as well. Simon, what are your views here? What do you think we can expect from Chancellor Philip Hammond, indeed Prime Minister Theresa May, together in terms of the direction of the economy, do you reckon?
I think that what we can expect is probably quite a bit of trying to talk up that confidence factor. I think that that was maybe one of the things that led to George Osborne's removal, was that he has been, you know, directly linked with that whole Project Fear, wandering around telling people the world's going to be really bad if we vote for Brexit. Mm. And I think it would be very difficult for him to then be wandering around telling people everything's absolutely fine. I think that we're going to see sort of some rowing back on austerity. And Osborne himself had already rowed back on that and said, well, actually, no, I'm probably not going to be able to balance the books by 2020 now. But I think we're probably going to find that balancing the books by 2020 go out the door. I think we're probably going to find some policies to try and help ordinary working people and maybe try and alleviate some of the tax burden. Because what Mark Carney said was, you know, there's a limit to what monetary policy can do. And what he's hinting at is now we need fiscal policy, and fiscal policy is tax and spending. So I think we'll probably see a bit of a rise in that. I mean, in all honesty, austerity, whilst it has hit some areas and it has hit some people, we've very much had austerity light in this country. You know, look at austerity in Ireland, look at austerity in Spain, look at austerity in Greece. You know, we haven't had austerity. You know, we've still continued to spend quite a lot of money. But I think they'll try and balance it that way. I think what we will see is probably a few less of George Osborne's, you know, sort of rabbit out the hat,
yeah,
possibly thinking a bit on the hoof kind of ideas.
But he did confirm, Rebecca, no emergency budget. A chance of George Osborne suggesting there could be in the run-up to the vote. What can we expect then from this autumn statement? But indeed, are we expecting anything much, or will it probably be a little bit steady as she goes because of all the upheaval recently?
I think given that there's not going to be an emergency budget, it's probably there's not going to be any big shocks coming up. I think Brexit is so huge, and that's going to be such a big topic to look through. I think there's probably not going to be anything massive. Who knows? We'll wait and see. But I think there won't be any big shocks.
But time to wave goodbye to that age of austerity, like perhaps Simon's suggesting, maybe moving, shifting away, ushering in an era of lower taxes. Very conservative idea, but government spending, not so much.
I don't know. I think that probably will happen, but I guess those normal working people, I think giving them more confidence, because at the moment it's so uncertain. I think that's going to be a huge task for the new government, and it'll be interesting to see how that works.
What do you think more generally, though, of what perhaps Theresa May has done, particularly with the cabinet? Very interesting. Lots of papers focusing on the fact that 70% state educated, it has the lowest proportion of privately educated ministers since Clement Attlee's Labour post-war government of 1945. What do you make of that, though, generally as well?
I think it's very interesting. The government's kind of been the same for the last like 4 or 5 years. I think it's a big change, but I also think they've got very big task on their hands. I think when we saw all the new people coming in, it was quite interesting. And
who stuck out for you?
Well, Boris is a bit of a shocker.
Boris Johnson, yeah.
Yeah, I think Osborne, like, that was, we knew that's going to happen. That wasn't really a huge surprise. But I think it will be interesting. I think they've got a really hard task trying to sort out what's happened, make a plan when there really isn't one at the moment for Brexit. So we shall see.
Simon, I want to ask, before we put this part to bed, Chancellor George Osborne and Prime Minister David Cameron, did they leave the economy in a better state than when they started? How would you assess that time at the helm for both of those men?
Yes, they absolutely left the economy in a better state than when they started. And you have to think back to the point when they started to assess that properly. You can't assess it from just looking back now and saying, well, I don't like this and I do like this and I don't like this. At the point when they took over, there were genuine concerns over the UK economy. The UK economy was basically really struggling to get any growth going in it. We were considered to be the sick man of Europe, you know, harking back to the 70s kind of thing. Europe was doing not too badly, actually, at that point. And there was real concern about basically our borrowing costs rocketing and that we needed to get a grip on our public finances. And I don't think that people believed that the opposition in the form of the Gordon Brown-led Labour Party would get a grip on the public finances. And the coalition government came in, not just the Tory government, the coalition government came in and they did make a good fist of making it look like they were getting a grip on the public finances. And that has been, you know, the foundation that we've built the recovery on. The recovery still isn't amazing. So I think they did a good job. I think Cameron actually did a good job. I think Cameron, for all the accusations of being some, you know, wealthy, eaten, educated, posh boy levelled at him, I think Cameron is and I know people who've worked with him, actually, worked for him, you know, worked under him, who said he is actually genuinely a nice guy. And I think he also has an empathy with normal people, you know, normal working people. I think he got it. You know, I don't think he was kind of very detached. I think you could maybe level that accusation at some of the people, you know, that surrounded the government in his cabinet. But I think Cameron did get it. Osborne, I think he did a decent job. But, you know, to be honest, I've got an article in front of me. Osborne was really, really struggling to get growth going. And I think Osborne made a fatal mistake in that he basically decided that he tried everything and he went, oh, well, I'm just going to roll the dice on the property market. And he rolled the dice on the property market. That helped get the confidence back, put a bit of swagger back in our step. But it hooked up our economy straight back up to the property market, which is something we were meant to be trying to unhook it from. And now we're almost in an even worse position in terms of how dependent we are on, oh God, if house prices fall, the economy's going to be completely knackered. You know, we could have almost kind of walked a little bit away from that. And I've got this column here, basically, 20th of March, 2013, basically. The Chancellor's first foray onto Twitter trailed his budget as helping those who want to work hard and get on, and that was a riff that he kept returning to in his speech. In the end, it was a good day for builders who want to relax after a hard day's work, as Mr. Osborne went long on both new homes and cheaper beer. So basically, he cut the beer tax rise that was meant to be coming in, and this was when he announced Help to Buy. And this is my problem with George Osborne, is that Help to Buy, basically in its initial form of lending money to people, lending, you know, deposits to people to buy new build homes. Yes, that does help the new build home market. But what it does is you basically, it doesn't increase supply unless sort of indirectly, and it gives money to people. It says these things are too expensive, so what we're going to do is we're going to give you some more money to buy them, which pushes the price of them up. And then you had Help to Buy on mortgages with like small deposit mortgages. Again, exactly the same problem. These things are too expensive, so we're going to give the people buying them more money. That pushes the prices up. It would have been a better idea to give the money to the builders, which would have been completely unpalatable. I'd love to see the Chancellor try and sell that to people. We're going to give interest-free loans to developers. But actually, that would have been the thing that got more homes built. So I think that that linking us straight back up, you know, to the property market will be a mistake that we pay for in years to come.
Well, we're going to stick with that theme. The Bank of England saying in its minutes that some businesses were starting to delay investment projects and postpone recruitment decisions while a, quote, significant weakening in activity in the housing market was expected as a result of Brexit. Figures released indeed earlier that day showed interest among UK home buyers fell to its lowest level since mid-2008. The Royal Institution of Chartered Surveyors said they expect house prices to fall across the UK over the next 3 months, with buyer demand falling at its sharpest rate on record, blaming that dip in confidence since the UK voted to leave the EU. Estate agent Michael Bruce says it's had an effect.
What we saw on the day of Brexit in particular was, you know, people starting to try and understand exactly what the impact might be for them. And we saw, you know, volumes of activity, volumes of calls and things like that certainly dampened down on that day.
Well, homeowner Hannah Wagner believes the result stopped her sale going through.
Well, the young couple were first-time buyers, and when Brexit happened, they got scared. They read somewhere that house prices would go down, and they got scared.
And here are the views of Paul Smee from the Council of Mortgage Lenders.
A lot of mortgages are for fixed rates, which last for a certain rate length of time. So any change in those rates will only happen at the end of the fix. And recently, about 90% of new lending has been going in fixed rates. So there'll be quite a few people who won't be affected at all. We think about 50% of borrowers are currently on fixed rates. Others, banks are going to have to take into account other things, funding costs, competition, profitability, assessment of future market conditions. They can't just look at the base rate. The average mortgage rate has fallen from 3.8% to 2.9% over the time when bank rate has stayed stable. So mortgage rates have already come down with bank rate not moving. And that, on the other side, means that there is no necessary correlation between bank rate coming down and all mortgage rates dropping. As for the housing market, since the results of the referendum, it's a bit early to say whether there's any clear trend in terms of turnover, in terms of house prices, in terms of anything really, because it is pretty recent news.
Too early to say, says Paul Smee from the Council of Mortgage Lenders, also talking about if the Bank of England does reduce rates next month, what could be the impact of that on the housing market. Rebecca, your thoughts? Too early to say?
I think it is too... Oh, I don't know. This story that we've been talking about this week about how some... They are smaller mortgage providers, but they've been pulling out of... if you've got a small deposit, they've pulled out that... A couple have pulled out that market. So I think if you're looking to buy a house and you haven't got that much money, whereas previously you might have been able to get a mortgage, lenders are a bit scared at the moment. They're a bit panicked by what's happened. So I think as a knee-jerk reaction from that, some smaller providers have pulled out of offering mortgages to people with a small deposit. However, optimistically, I think that hopefully this will be a short-term thing. And again, because it is so recent since we've had the vote, hopefully things will recover.
What is the advice to anyone right now thinking about buying or selling? Just wait and see, ride it out, go with it?
I think wait and see, but I think just get advice. Like, if it depends what stage you are, whether you're just thinking about it or whether you've seen a property. I think it depends where you are along the line, but just speak to an advisor, try and get some advice on that.
Simon?
Well, I always think the best time to try and buy something is when other people aren't trying to buy it. because mm-hmm. that's when you're going to be able to negotiate the best deal. So people might want to be thinking about that. You know, you might already be starting to see some of these properties being reduced. There's already less. There was less demand in the run up to the vote. We were being told by estate agents. People were sitting on their hands a bit because people kept walking. Chancellor kept walking around telling them house prices were going to fall if we vote to leave the EU. And the message got through. So now it's the question of whether those people are coming straight back in. Or whether, and so maybe you should just wait and see a little bit and give it a few months to filter out, or whether you should be trying to get in now. So I'd test the waters with some below asking price offers if you're looking to buy a house. You know, try and be cheeky. You know, try and get the price down. Try and work on the basis that, you know, try and find out who the person is who's selling and try and negotiate yourself the best deal. But I was speaking to a mortgage broker, Andrew Montlake of Correco, earlier this week, and he was saying that actually, whilst they did have a slowdown, you know, pre-Brexit and kind of just after Brexit, they've seen loads of people coming back in, you know, actually trying to buy houses. So maybe it won't have that big an effect.
Editor Simon Lambert.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NSandI.com, helping you keep on top of your savings whenever, wherever.
Well, if buying, renting, selling a home wasn't tough enough, we're being warned of a new trick to watch out for now. It's called portal juggling, and it relates to how old a listing is. Here's property guru Henry Pryor.
Portal juggling is a real problem for those looking to buy or rent properties because it gives a false impression of what estate agents have to sell and to let. It gives a false impression of the market. It distorts the market. It is, in my opinion, although this is not tested in law, something that would stretch the Competition and Markets Authority and potentially other regulators across the estate and letting agency industry. Because, of course, the big problem for anyone who's ever tried to find a home, either to rent or to buy, is that they ring up the estate agent and say, I'm sorry, it's gone. I'm sorry, that property is no longer available. Agents are doing this in order to look bigger and better than they are. They're doing this to look like they've got more inventory and they are therefore perhaps more successful, so the statistics will show, than they really are. Because if they can take the same property, appear to market it twice, appear to sell it twice, they've clearly got twice as much success than if they were actually to stick with the rules. And this is a problem really for the main property websites and portals. They, like Rightmove and Zoopla and On the Market, have a real problem trying to deal with this because if an estate agent gives them the listing, of course, they assume that that estate agent is telling the truth. But I'm afraid, breaking news on Share Radio as we do so often, this, I'm afraid, is that estate agents sometimes fib.
Estate agents sometimes fib, Rebecca?
Hmm.
What is this?
Yeah, this is a bit of a sneaky one. Basically, there's lots of online portals where you can buy and sell property. What they're doing is kind of manipulating how they list property. So if something's been up there for a long time, they take it off the site, put it back on. So for someone who doesn't know, it looks like a brand new property. And it also bumps it up in Google and in newsletters.
Why is that good for them?
It's good for them because these properties that, for some reason, we don't know what, haven't been selling, they've been on there a long time, there could be a problem. It could just be that, I don't know, people are not interested, but I think it just creates more interest for that property because suddenly it's at the top of the rankings rather than on the sixth page where no one's going to look at it.
But does it make such a difference then how far up something is? Are we just so lazy we're not going to look down to page six? Because presumably it'll just keep going down. There's obviously something wrong with
it, maybe. Well, if you get to page six, see something, and then you see it's been up there for the last few months, you might question why it's been there, why it hasn't been sold, where the interest is. Whereas if it's brand new, well, it looks like it's brand new at the top of the page, you're more likely to have a look and more likely to be interested in that place. So I think the thing is, it's kind of misleading for the person buying the house or who's interested in the house. And there's a really good quote, actually, from an estate agent, Chris Wood, of PDQ Property. He says, buyers are being misled. It's the equivalent of being sold a stale piece of cheese dressed up as fresh produce.
Okay, all right then. But as a matter of fact, it seems conventional portal juggling is not the only form. It goes on. Here's Henry Pryor again.
We're already starting to see agents coming up with the latest version of portal juggling, which is the coming soon advertisement. They go out and they look at a property. They're invited to see a property which somebody wants to either let out or to sell. They come scurrying back to their office. They put it up on the web, coming soon, and they have a broad description, you know, in Clerkenwell, three bedrooms. And there again, you see they've got a listing which makes them look bigger than they are because they aren't actually instructed at this stage to offer the property. When they are instructed, if they are instructed, it then goes on again as another record. So suddenly they look like they're offering twice as much property as in fact they are. And when, of course, that property is let or sold, then once again, it looks like they're being far more successful than the reality.
Simon, is more regulation needed here?
I don't think so. I mean, you can't regulate against everything. I think there's an issue here for the portals, and they say that actually they don't see this as a big problem, right? Mm. That they, they don't see it as a widespread issue. Rightmove said Rightmove has a dedicated data quality team to ensure people see the most accurate information when they search for a home. We have technology to detect and prevent attempts to upload incorrect listings. And Zoopla said, this is not a widespread issue and the overwhelming majority of agents do not engage in these practices. For those few who do, we have a number of processes and detection tools in place to prevent this. I mean, the thing is like, basically, there's a couple of... people will often search for most recent properties. So this gets you into the most recent properties. It also gets you into the alerts that you'll sign up for when you're looking for a house, of like the properties that have just come on the market. And if you keep getting them and you keep looking at them, you're obviously going to spot if the same house keeps coming up. But I think it's probably, there's regulation in place anyway. You know, the estate agents have to be honest. You know, there's laws that basically say that they have to be honest and they can't misrepresent the property. So I guess the thing to do is, if you see this happening as a buyer, you know, contact Trading Standards and say, I think that this is going on, and try and see if you can get them to follow up on it. And maybe that's the kind of thing that would crack down on it. I think, you know, the real issue is for agents is with a property that's been on for ages, is if the property's been on the market for 3 months and it hasn't sold, then you can go make that low offer, can't you? You can lowball them with the offer and say, well, look, it's not sold for 3 months, has it? So ask the agent, say, that should actually be one of the first questions that you ask the agent. How long has this property been on the market? And if they sound like they're trying to befuddle you or make excuses, or like, oh, well, it was, then you know that they're lying.
Editor Simon Lambert and Rebecca Rupp, personal finance reporter from This Is Money. Coming up, parking rage. But even before you navigate the rough terrain of estate agents, you need to work out, indeed, where you want to live. So let's focus on the positive. Celebrate our great British towns and cities that you may want to consider living in. So where are the best places to live, to work, and indeed to breathe? Well, it seems like it's turning up roses for Milton Keynes, no less, named second only behind Cambridge as the best place to work in the UK. Incidentally, London didn't make the list. Probably unsurprising when you think of factors such as how easy it is to get to work, the cost of living and overall job satisfaction were considered. But now the town, famous for its roundabouts, could soon be crowned the greenest city. It's launching its first green vehicle permit, giving electric cars free parking and the right to use bus lanes soon. But first, what is so good about Milton Keynes? Here's Share Radio's market commentator Chris Bailey from Financial Orbit with an unashamedly biased view.
Obviously, I've spent most of my working life in London. You have to do it, but ultimately you want to lose the grime, you want to go elsewhere. There's only one place for me, and it is the silver medal runner-up. It's the place I actually do live. I do have an office, and I do currently... I will be working there later on today when I leave these fine offices, and that, of course, is Milton Keynes, the city of the grid network. The thing is, because it's a new city, new facilities, and consequently you get none of this sort of stuff which is sort of built up, which is no longer any use. Very convenient for London if you wish to come down here, like I do on a very frequent basis, on a Tuesday and a Wednesday primarily. And property prices are somewhat keener than London. Open University is there. Countryside, I love my cycling and stuff, is 5 minutes from my front door. It's brilliant.
I'd like to assure you we've not been employed by the tourist board of Milton Keynes. This is some facts that we've got here, Simon. So second best place to work in the UK and now vying to be super uber green.
Yes. Was Chris just telling us that Milton Keynes is great because it's easy to get out of?
Yeah, that's quite plausible.
I love it when people say about how wonderful somewhere is when they basically give all kinds of reasons about how it's really easy to leave. No, Milton Keynes is going to make it even easier for you to leave and even cheaper for you to leave, actually, because they are basically one of these testbed towns, cities. Is it a city nowadays? I know they wanted to be a city, didn't they? They stole someone else's football team as well, didn't they, Georgie?
Yeah, don't talk about that.
Yeah. But they're going to make it even easier for you to get around if you've got an electric car, because you will now get this special green permit and that will let you park for free. So you can spend more time in Milton Keynes because you'll be parked. And you can also drive in the bus lanes if you need to escape Milton Keynes quickly. And Milton Keynes is a great place for driving if you love roundabouts. Mm. But this is all part of this big move to try and get us to buy greener cars. So you've got all of these incentives to encourage people to do it. So you've got a government grant that takes some of the money off, and then they're making it easier for people to park them. What they really need to do is make it easier for people to charge them. That's the key thing. And, you know, that is a bit easier, but it's not that easy. Mm. Regular listeners to the show will know that we had a Tesla on test for a week a while back, which was an absolutely wonderful car. I drove it all the way to Wales and back. You use Tesla's supercharger network on the motorway, can half charge it in 20 minutes. It's absolutely perfect. But you know what I can't do? I cannot charge it anywhere near my house. No. And I live in what is nowadays judged to be pretty central London. I live in Zone 2 London. I can't take a plug lead over the pavement because I live in a flat. I can't take it out of my house over the pavement and plug it in from the house. And the two nearest electric car charging points are a bus ride away. And you're not going to plug your electric car in and then get the bus back to your house. Yeah. And if that's the situation in London, then, you know, the target market for these people, these urban professionals kind of thing, it's going to be very difficult to attract them. You know, if you had a house with a drive, obviously it's absolutely fine. Mm. But I think those people with the big houses with the drives are going to be the harder people to get to take on the electric cars.
So the technology is there. The technology is there. It's just the practicalities aren't.
Yeah, and that's what this Milton Keynes thing is about. Yeah. It's about pushing the practicalities. But, you know, as to why it's a great place to work, I'm not so sure. But I know a person who knows a lot more about it than I do.
Rebecca, you've been looking into that. Why is it such a great place to work?
Well, I have to say, Milton Keynes, yeah, it's kind of a surprise number two. Cambridge is number one, there's Oxford in there. There's lots of very green, beautiful places, not that far from London. But it's based on a number of things. It's kind of property prices with the average amount people earn, population size. Not surprisingly, London didn't even make it in the list because it's so expensive. Cardiff didn't make it in the list either. There was nowhere in Wales. However, Edinburgh and Glasgow were up there. But yeah, Milton Keynes is a nice place.
I don't think I've ever been to Milton Keynes, you know.
I've driven through it.
I've been to Milton Keynes. It's quite nice.
I don't know if I've stopped.
Yeah, there's some of the old villages that were kind of swallowed up by Milton Keynes are really nice, actually. And the town centre is very sort of modern kind of thing. It's got a good theatre. Snow Dome. And it's got shops.
Oh, I think they have been to that Snow Dome.
Yeah,
there you go.
Yeah.
And it's also got now 15,000, or should do, free parking spaces for green cars. But what if you don't have one? Tempted to nip in, even if you're a diesel or something, just do your shop. No one will mind. Wrong. We've all heard of road rage, but it seems there's something new to watch out for. And I'm sure we've all felt it at times.
Yeah, it's a worrying new trend, really. Parking rage comes about as a result of a number of things. Basically, people parking inconsiderably and somebody else getting a bit angry about it. Apparently, 3/4 of Brits admit to getting wound up by poor parking. But it's quantifiable as well. We've seen an increase in claims for vandalism. So this anger is turning into criminal damage as well. We have heard some rather horrible stories about people being quite badly injured as a result of this sort of thing. But thankfully, that is very, very few and far between, but seen a rise in claims for vandalism, things like keying cars and the like, and it can all so easily be avoided by being more considerate and just being a little bit more chilled when you're behind the wheel.
Yeah, just relax. That was Steve Fowler, editor-in-chief from Auto Express. So 2/3 of people believe it's a basic right to park outside your own home. 1 in 7 have left an angry note on someone's windscreen. Indeed, 1 in 17, or 6%, have even let the offending car's tyres down. Simon, I know you like the subject of parking. Let it out. Have a bit of rage.
Okay, the one thing I would point out is if you let the offending car's tyres down, you are cutting it off your nose to spite your face, because the offending car will then find it harder to move out of the space that you so covet. So, people, think about that. And don't key cars. That's not nice. That's very, very not nice.
It's slightly illegal as well.
Yeah, it's illegal. It's not nice. It's evil. But no, basically, people... It's funny, isn't it? People do actually expect to be able to park directly outside their door, or they'll have a favourite spot that they park in. Obviously, if you've got a drive, this isn't an issue, but lots of people don't have drives. And you get there and you discover someone's in your favourite spot, or they've parked right outside your house, and you get grumpy about it. And I live on a road in London, and I come home sometimes, and I don't get too grumpy about it, but it is annoying when there's nowhere to park and you have to walk a bit to your house. But then really you think about it, it's like you live in a major city and you've just had to walk 2 minutes to your house from your car. What are you expecting here, man. I mean, are you a lunatic? But what does really annoy me, okay, is people who just can't park properly. So you come back, there's a line of cars, and people have parked, but they haven't parked up against the car in front, you know, leaving that reasonable gap so people could get in and out. They've left a sort of half car space. And you've got a road on which you could fit at least a handful, you know, of extra cars if people could just park properly. But you can't because there's like half car spaces between all of them. You want to push them all together.
Yeah.
We used to, do you know, we used to do that when I was at school, when we used to parking outside my school used to be difficult. And what we used to do is there was one space you could get the car in, but you couldn't quite get it in. So we'd put the car as much as we could in, and then we'd basically get out, lift up the back of the car, and then wheel the car into the space. And we did used to occasionally sort of just, if, only if it was a friend's car, we'd basically lift up their car and move it forwards a bit and get one into
Goodness
the space.
Me. How's your back now, Simon?
Well, small cars. These cars were small and light in those days. Don't try it now, people.
No.
These cars are really heavy.
Don't indeed. What really gets you, Rebecca?
So I have to admit, I'm a terrible parker. I'm one of those people.
Okay.
I'm awful at parking. And so I am the person that people, I have had a note on the car before.
Mm.
It was like a sticky one that someone put right in the middle of the windscreen and I couldn't get it off. But I thought I deserved that because I'm a pretty terrible parker.
I'm with you, Simon, though. The ones that, you know, you go to a supermarket or something, people have just straddled two spaces.
Yeah. That's probably me.
It's generally the Chelsea tractors that are always the way and it's just move.
Well, we should count ourselves lucky, though. I mean, one of my best friends lives in Milan, and in Milan they have a thing called the Milanese kiss, which is basically where you park your car in a space by repeatedly ramming the one in front and the one behind to squeeze yourself into this too small space. So you get in and you just go bang, 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 backwards and forwards. And I mean, my friend's, you know, parents-in-law's car, he said it's maybe like 2 years old, and the thing is just covered in dents and dings and scratches. And everything like that. So,
take a deep breath, everyone. Just take a deep breath. Editor Simon Lambert and Rebecca Rupp, personal finance reporter from This Is Money. Thank you so much for joining us.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, looking after the nation's savings for over 150 years.